move on to the next type of management, which is management of hardwood bottomlands. And, you know, hardwood bottomlands pretty much can manage themselves if they flood naturally. But because things have been altered quite a bit in our watersheds, they don't flood naturally. Therefore, hardwood bottomland habitat is often not available in a predictable capacity or on a widespread capacity like it used to be. So that has resulted in the conception of what's called green tree reservoir management, which is basically creating an infrastructure where you manage the hydrology within a hardwood bottomland, and you also manage the tree composition. So, let's start off with defining hardwood bottomlands. And a general definition of a hardwood bottomland are forested wetlands generally near a river that are periodically flooded during the dormant and growing season by overbank flow. These are floodplain areas, y'all. So during winter and during part of the growing season, usually early in spring, associated with spring rains, these areas get flooded. They're often flooded long enough, at least portions of them, to meet that 5% of the growing season duration. But then the water, as water recedes, as the river stages go down, then water gets back in the banks, and so those are hardwood bottomlands. And usually there are quite a few oak species that are present. Oaks are a typical component. As we get into areas that have more bald cypress and things like that, tupelo, those are hardwood bottomland areas, but we usually don't manage those specifically for waterfowl, unless they're going to be managed as roosting sites, which means they're there and birds go in there and they may roost in there or they may get away from inclement weather and parabon and all that stuff. But as far as food production areas, hardwood bottomlands that have an oak component are ones that we are looking for and that we manage for. We try to promote oak species for a couple different reasons. Okay, so hardwood bottomland forests, again, to kind of make a foundation within the cordon system here. We're in the palustrine system. The class is forested wetland, and there are two classes that are typical of hardwood bottomland forest. There are needleleaf deciduous and there are broadleaf deciduous. Needleleaf deciduous would be being dominated, for example, by bald cypress and tupelo usually. Well, tupelo isn't needleleaf deciduous, but you'll have tupelo in there with right along with bald cypress. And then over here in broadleaf deciduous, you have a variety of oak species, water tupelo. And that's overcup oak, cherry bark oak, and willow oak. And then there's also water oak. And those were the species that I listed on the board yesterday. These tend to be the needleleaf deciduous. Well, obviously, bald cypress is an obligate wetland species. And broadleaf can be obligate wetland to facultative. And usually, of course, bald cypress, the water regime, they're semi-permanently flooded. Whereas broadleaf deciduous, they can be temporarily flooded, which is very common. Again, they're just temporarily flooded, short period of time during early part of the growing season, and the water's well below the surface of the soil. or they can be seasonally flooded where they just hold water through the growing season and water is off by the end of the growing season. Okay. Waterfowl when we talk about managing green tree reservoirs, we're talking about managing for waterfowl. Certainly there are other species such as amphibians that will take advantage of hardwood bottomland areas and will lay their eggs in those areas. But green tree reservoir management was conceived out of waterfowl management. The other thing is these areas, we'll talk about management in just a moment and techniques and important things to consider. So waterfowl that use hardwood bottomlands throughout the annual cycle, what would those be? Your cavity nesters? Wood ducks, hooded mergansers. What are some other cavity nesters, do y'all know? As far as waterfowl, yeah. Wood ducks, hooded mergansers. One of them is more of a cavity nester than the other. I think the black-bellied is more of a cavity nester, and I think fulvis is more of a grassland nester. Common merganser is as well. And then we have the golden eyes. And so we have wood duck, hooded merganser, which are certainly our residents around here. That is a wood duck duckling. You can tell the difference between wood ducks and other ones because they have the line doesn't go through the eye. I think that's pretty typical I think most other species the line goes through the eye. So these are using, I guess this is throughout the annual cycle. Then on this slide is basically they're using it for part of the annual cycle, and they're using it for breeding. So these are nesting in hardwood bottomlands. And actually that includes the black duck. Black duck is not a cavity nester, but they nest in the boreal forest, and they will nest on logs, etc., of the boreal forest, eastern North America. Cavity nesters include golden eyes, or other cavity nesters include the common golden eye and the Beryl's golden eye, and also the bufflehead and the common merganser. Those are all cavity nesters. Okay. Here are species that they breed or they nest in grasslands, but they'll use forested wetlands during the winter. Can you think of some of those species? Nest in grasslands up in the prairie pothole region, but you'll find them in bottomlands down here. Mallards, yeah, definitely. Gadwall, widgeon, American widgeon. What else? Oh, ringneck duck is a diver that it really has an affinity towards hardwood bottomlands. And this particular diver, most divers, I'm not sure if Melissa talked about this when quality. They take off, they run across the water, whereas dabbling ducks will jump and pretty much take off straight up. This is one diver that really, it'll kind of run, but it kind of jumps, and it really takes off like a dabbling duck. And consequently, it really can use forested wetlands. If you have to run along water for a distance, you're not going to be able to fly into and take off in a forested wetland area very easily. correspondingly, you don't see, not, I mean, it when you have a closed canopy, a lot of times you won't see very many, well, you won't have geese in there. They need an open, more open area as well. Okay, here are some species that may use forested wetlands in the winter that breed and nest in grasslands. American green-winged teal and widgeon, which I already mentioned, American widgeon. Okay. So here are some functions of hardwood bottomlands, most of which we've really already talked about before. Of course, birds are in here. They'll use these flooded areas, waterfowl will, and they'll acquire various food resources, including aquatic invertebrates. First and foremost, and probably the most abundant, are aquatic invertebrates, and then acorns, if there's, you know, significant mass production. And in openings, in forest openings, if it's a moist area, you'll get moist soil seed production in those openings. Of course, the areas provide shelter from inclement weather, protection from predators, are important areas for courtship and pair bonding, and simply for resting also, okay? So, four uses of bottomlands. Good, any questions so far? All right, bottomland foods, acorns, inverts, and again, moist soil seeds, especially in these openings. And we'll talk about managing forest openings, y'all, because these are great areas for birds. You need to open up, actually, a hardwood bottomland. They need to have openings, whether it's natural or you can manage these, for them to come in and land. Then they'll swim up into the trees and stuff like that. But these openings can have really good moist soil production, and they can also be hunting zones for folks to, and you can even come in here and put, if you want, put Japanese millet or put a little food plot in here as well, right within a hardwood bottomland. We'll talk about the size of these a little bit later. I won't comment on it right now. Okay, other wildlife that use bottomlands, lots of different things, a variety of passerines, warblers, herpetofauna, mammals, certainly fish. When these areas end up flooding, especially in the springtime, if the water stays up for a while, they can be important spawning areas and nursery areas for fish. They're also excellent timber producing areas, and we'll talk about the difference in timber value in a little bit, depending on the composition of oaks. But oaks are highly valuable timber. Lots of them, you can get saw timber and veneer logs, especially these species here, cherry bark oak, willow oak, and water oak. And then all the environmental functions that we talked about before, flood and erosion control and nutrient cycling, groundwater recharge, all are important functions of hardwood bottomlands. Good. So, yeah, the bottom line on bottomlands. Hardwood bottomlands are critical ecosystems that play an integral role in the function of many ecological and environmental processes. Okay, let's talk about the hydrology within bottomlands. Typical hydrology within bottomlands is very dynamic. It's very stochastic, it's very random. You know, you get flood, rain events, and technically flood events when the river comes over its bank. This is in an unaltered system, and you can have on day one, you can have flooding like this. This is actually Noxubee Wildlife Refuge. Noxubee River is right to the left. We'll drive down this road here, and that bottom land frequently would flood. Whenever the Noxubee River comes over its banks, I'm here on day one, you come back on day five, and there's the road. So it's a very dynamic type system. So natural hydroperiod is characterized by stochastic and ephemeral flooding events. Stochastic is just means random, y'all. Ephemeral is short, okay? Short-lived. All right. Now, Green Tree Reservoir. What is a Green Tree Reservoir, y'all? What have you heard? Have y'all talked about Green Tree Reservoirs? Did Billy talk much about them?
A little bit, yeah. We saw some in South Carolina.
Okay. So what is a Green Tree Reservoir? How would you define it?
A forested stand that's periodically flooded, you know, in the winter. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Exactly. So a green tree reservoir is simply a hardwood bottomland forest that is surrounded either partially or completely by levees that has a water control structure or multiple water control structures that allow you to manipulate the hydrology. And typically it's flooded up during the dormant season. And to provide predictable flooded hardwood bottomland areas for migrating wintering waterfowl. Okay? That is a green tree. And the goal of it is to provide predictable habitat. And that's important. You know, there's at least, I mean, just in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, only 20% of the original hardwood bottomlands remain. And that was the dominant wetland type. It still is the dominant wetland type in the United States and in the Southeast. But the availability is much less now. Moreover, because of all the channelization that's occurred, bottomlands don't flood like they used to. So functionally, if they're not flooded, the duck's just not going to lay in and walk around on the forest floor. Okay? Not a good strategy. Needs to be flooded. So green tree reservoirs provide that predictable hydrology. Okay? And if it's done properly, they can be very effective and can help meet some of these life cycle needs of acquiring food resources as well as the other ones that we've talked about. So a green tree reservoir is one, again, a hardwood bottomland that is enclosed partially or completely by levees and contains water control structures. The primary goal, historically, of green tree reservoir management is to provide wildlife use and specifically waterfowl use during migration and winter. The secondary goal is timber production. So you're often, when you are working on an area and you're doing green tree reservoir management, you're writing timber prescriptions or you're working with your forester to do timber type prescriptions. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. Okay, so what you're managing is the hydrology within these sites, and you're also managing the tree vigor, the growth of the trees, and the composition of the trees. Okay. And again, the whole idea is to provide flooded habitat, hardwood bottomland habitat, forested wetland habitat for waterfowl more predictably. Okay? Yep, two goals. Wildlife, timber, and this goes with the wildlife if you provide more predictable habitat. That's important. Because I don't know if y'all have heard, GTRs have gotten a bad rap in some areas. And Tennessee is one of those areas where they're not considered a very effective waterfowl management tool. Yeah, I'm here to tell you, being podcasted, that they are, okay? They are, and they can be a very effective waterfowl management tool. And they're being used in other parts of the Mississippi Alluvial Valley very effectively. And we've learned from managing in the past of how to manage effectively. There are certainly ways that you shouldn't manage. And there are locations where probably green tree reservoirs should not be put, and there should be in other areas, and they could be put in other areas. Now, with respect to that, this first handout is a really good publication that is available at least electronically via the website. Both of these are. One is the Green Tree Reservoir Management Handbook by Lee Fredrickson and Don Batema. And then on the back side of it is, where do you put a green tree reservoir? So basically a guidebook to actually putting a green tree reservoir in, where it should be located, and the processes of going through that. And that was written by Dr. Sammy King, who was here at UT, who I replaced, who's now at LSU, and of course, Dr. Fredrickson there again. I'll pass this Green Tree Reservoir Management Handbook around. I have a hard copy of it, just for you to take a look. Again, I don't think you can get a hard copy anymore. I think they're certainly out of print. I doubt if there's any around. If you could, you would contact the Gaylord Memorial Lab in Missouri. You could just Google it and find it and ask them if they have any left, because it's a classic text. It's great. And the second handout that you have here is, again, this says WFS 560. Just ignore that. This is something I put together a while ago, and again, it kind of, just like the moist soil handout, it kind of goes through and explains, you know, how it fits into the cordon system, which we've already gone through. Talks about the important uses and needs of bottomland forests, the history of green tree reservoir management, and ultimately, this really kind of summarizes pretty much my lecture, now that I'm looking at it. Okay, so, all right. So, traditional green tree reservoir management. This is basically, a survey was done back in the 80s here to look and see how are folks managing the hydrology within green tree reservoirs. And they said, okay, they came back and the majority of them flooded annually. They flooded and they brought the water up and they held the water stable. They held it at least 1 meter in depth, okay, so thigh deep. And this was basically, they flooded up starting in, September, October-ish, and they held it constant, and then they pulled the plug, in February or March, and water levels would drop, but then with spring rains, they would come back up. And functionally, what occurred in many green tree reservoirs, what was occurring is you had flooding from October through into April, okay, that water was on that. This is obviously not during just the dormant season, is it? All right, when you flood trees for that long a duration, especially things that are not bald cypress, there's going to be problems. And if you can compare that with natural hydrology within a bottomland that's, again, quite dynamic here, it may be this, you know, September, you may have some fall rains and stuff comes up. And a lot of times you have, it's even more dynamic than you see here. It'll come up. It's very shallow, first of all. Notice that. It's not stable. And a lot of times, you know, the rivers go back in their bank and it'll come back down here and it'll be dry for a while, then it'll flood back up, etc. So the whole point here is a very dynamic hydrology. It's not as deep. And you should, actually I should have in here some periods where it's dry, even during the growing season, not during the growing season, etc. So All right. Definitely, the graph on the right is quite different than the graph on the left. Okay. The first Green Tree Reservoir was put in at Grand Prairie Management Area in Stuttgart, Arkansas, in the late 1930s. Somebody, you know, just duck biologists and consequently duck hunters very quickly after this. Many duck clubs have Green Tree Reservoirs. Said, wow, you know, there's birds using these bottomlands. Why don't we just put a levee around them and flood these bottomlands? And nationwide now, there's about 180 Green Tree Reservoirs. Most of them are in the southeast. There are a couple up in New York. And a few in Texas, if you want to include those in the southeast too. So the initial responses that folks were reporting is, man, waterfowl use, I mean, they just flocked to these areas, and they did. You had an increase in viable acorn production and an increase in radial growth of the trees. And just think about those last two things there. I'll just mention this right now. This is likely a result initially of increased soil moisture. This is likely a consequence of stressing the tree. When you stress trees, they'll produce a bumper crop, and then what happens, which we'll see in the next slide, acorn production drops as the tree ultimately starts to die. And so that's what the original studies done in the 60s and stuff were like, oh, this is great, Green Tree Reservoirs are great. And then a variety of studies through the 70s and the 80s started documenting a decline in waterfowl use, a decline in acorn production, a decline in radial tree growth, and mortality of trees and reduced regeneration. The trees are just, you're stressing them too much. There's too much water during the growing season. And you need to think about even outside the growing season. If you're flooding these from basically, the growing season ends in Tennessee, end of October, beginning of November. If you have water on it right then and you hold it until the beginning of the growing season and pull water off, which beginning of growing season is right around now, mid-March or so, water is gonna come off, you know, even if you just, let's say you could just take it off exactly on those dates, there's still going to be lingering effects in the soil from saturated soil condition having a bottomland flooded for that long, and that's not natural. Okay. Consequently, there have been folks that have suggested that, oh, Green Tree Reservoir management is a poor technique. Abolish it from wetland management. And I'll tell you, I'll mention again, I mean, there are ways to manage Green Tree Reservoirs and there are ways not to manage it. And I've seen firsthand effective Green Tree Reservoir management in Mississippi. It occurs in Arkansas and it occurs in many other southeastern states. And it can occur in Tennessee. Will mentioned that there are cases, one's Tigrit Wildlife Management Area, and another is Gooch Wildlife Management Area, where there are bottomlands that are flooded for 6 months of the year, and things are dying. And because of the history in Tennessee of observing some of those cases, Tigrit, which is not the fault of TWR. I mean, it's because of altered hydrology within that bottomland. But at Gooch, they start putting water on that area at the end of September. They still do, and they hold the water through February, and. There are trees that are dying at Gooch right now because of that management practice. So you know, the biologists realize and they see, okay, this is maybe, you know, this is killing trees. We know this. Science is behind it. We're observing it here, so this is not an effective technique. I'm going to tell you how to manage green tree reservoirs here in a little bit, which you might suspect includes not flooding them for very long, right? Trying to emulate hydrology a little more. I mention this because this is really surfaced. Well, let me just back up for a second. I'm not pointing a finger at anybody, certainly within our state. The reason that Gooch Wildlife Management Area is flooded at the end of September is because it is the only way that they can flood all of their management units so that by open season in November, Thanksgiving, all of them are flooded and all the duck hunters are happy. If they try to flood later than that, the infrastructure is such that it is impossible for them to flood all of the areas and have them at full pool by the time duck season opens. And the biologist there is very aware, and he would rather flood later, but that would result in some of the areas not being available for hunting until after the duck season starts. And because of politics and political pressure of hunters in that area, it's forced the biologists at Gooch to flood during the growing season, which is affecting tree composition within the bottomlands. The way that the flooding exists there is they're actually flooding food plot areas that they have and bottomland areas, but really they have to flood through the bottomlands to flood ultimately the food plot areas where the majority of the hunting zones are. All right, now I bring this all up too because there is a controversy which you may or may not have heard of. There's an area called Black Swamp. Black Swamp is a part of, is it a part of Hoppin Refuge? You guys from West Tennessee? How many folks have heard of the Black Swamp controversy? None. Good. Let me tell you about it. All right. You have two handouts here about Black Swamp, including one that is most recent developments in November of this year, which is the one that is stapled, and another one that says duck levee is a bad idea. TWA calls off duck hunting reservoir. Okay, which was dated 2004. Okay, that's 2004. This one, this is 2007. Kind of ironic, right? Okay, first of all, I'm going to give you a little bit of history. Y'all are aware of channelization in West Tennessee. Mention that. If you guys want a pretty neat read about West Tennessee and just in general river channelization and the effects it can have on bottomland systems, go over to our bookstore and buy this book. Okay, this is published by University of Tennessee Press, and it's the author is Jim Johnson, who's a retired TWRA biologist. And he talks about the history of channelization and the effects of it. And this is just published in 2007. I'll pass it around. It's actually a required reading for my advanced wetlands class. But it's a good book. It's an easy book. And whether you're from Tennessee or not, just reading it is a very interesting historical perspective. Jim does a good job doing that. Okay, so in the 60s and early 70s, the Corps of Engineers was channelizing the Obine River, the South Fork of the Obine River, and there's a pretty prominent businessman, Clark Akers, who I believe he's an engineer. And Clark, ultimately, the Corps was actually channelizing past his property where he had a waterfowl hunting area. And Clark said, man, this is what was happening is they were channelizing and they were destroying thousands upon thousands of acres of hardwood bottomlands, and ultimately went by Clark Acres property and affected hunting on his area. So initially, Clark got involved, and he took the core to court. And it was the first case, I don't know if it's the first case that a civilian has ever attempted to sue the Corps of Engineers, but I will say this, it was the first time that a civilian took the Corps of Engineers to court, and he won. And he says, this is downright illegal. You know, I mean, what you're doing is destroying tons of habitat. You're reducing opportunities for me to hunt as well as other Tennesseans, and the court decided against the Corps, and the court decided at that point that of the two, they had estimated that 200,000 acres of hardwood bottomlands were destroyed because of the Corps' activities through their channelization of the Obine, and they were fined. They were ordered to purchase 32,000 acres in compensation for the 200,000 acres that they destroyed to mitigate the damage. That's a pretty good deal, if you ask me. But that court order was in the 80s, and pretty much the Corps didn't do anything until 94, and the governor at that time forced them to, and so ultimately they said, okay, we'll buy 16,000 acres of property and we'll give it to TWRA to manage. And of that, Gooch, there were going to be 15 WMAs, Gooch Wildlife Management Area, Gooch A and E units were created from that. Okay? All right. As part of that deal, the land of which is now Hoppin Refuge and the Black Swamp area, which I think actually technically, I think Black Swamp is a part of, also was given to TWRA. The court order indicates that TWRA will be given the land and that these areas will be developed for production for waterfowl hunting opportunities. Okay? And again, that was the point. These bottomlands were being destroyed. We need to have waterfowl hunting opportunities for Tennesseans. Okay. So Gooch was developed in historical type management, where, again, we just talked a little bit about Gooch and the way that it's structured. And even the way the management currently exists. Hoppin is very similar. It has a bunch of units and stuff that are managed. And there was a proposal to, in the mid-90s, to go into the area known as Black Swamp and to build a levee to create a green tree reservoir. And nothing really happened. And there was some political pressure by Clark Acres, and the agency was moving forward with building that levee, and as it started to get more heated about whether or not they should build a levee, they needed to get permits to build that levee from TDEC, and TDEC initially denied the permit. So TDEC said, you know what, you shouldn't be going into this bottomland and you shouldn't be building a levee. So TDEC went against what TWRA was doing, which was just ultimately based on this court order. That really kind of upset Clark Acres and some other folks, and ultimately, TWRA said, listen, what we will do is, why don't we look at getting some experts to make a judgment call on this. And so TWRA solicited Lee Fredrickson and Sammy King to go in and to make an independent evaluation. So they went into the area, Lee and Sammy did, and they decided, you know what, this is not a good place to put a Green Tree Reservoir. And so with that advice, which was given in 2004, which is right about the time that I got here, TWRA said, you know what, we're not going to build the levee, forget it, forget the permit anyways, we're not going to press it, it's not a good idea. Well, lo and behold, I thought that that was it, everybody thought that that was it. But all of a sudden, last year, a water control structure and a levee was built without a TDEC permit. And nobody's talking about why that happened. It cost about $100,000 of state funds went into it. And TWRA, at least the spokesperson for them, is indicated that the permit was not required. And probably it isn't, although TDEC is now extremely pissed. Because basically, the point was, we shouldn't. TDEC was saying, you shouldn't build it. We're not going to give you the permit. You shouldn't be building in the floodplain. There was an independent study and advice provided by experts, and they said, no, you shouldn't, and then this happened. Certainly, Clark Acres has been a part of getting this management underway, and in his defense, his claim is that simply this is a court order that was handed down by federal court to develop this area, whether it's good or bad, whatever, to develop it for waterfowl management. And by God, I want to see it done. Okay? Well, Clark knows all the governors for the past, since 1970. And he has very strong political connections, and he does have a court order after all. So I thought I would just share with you what this project looks like, because we had a field trip last fall to this area. So Hoppin Refuge is directly adjacent to Black Swamp. In fact, again, I think Black Swamp is a part of it. And this is an area we stopped, and this is where a new levee has been built. I'm going to draw here on, and I guess I got a little bit of a space right here, kind of give you a feeling for where this levee is. And here is Black Swamp, like here. There's actually a road here. And there's a drainage channel that comes out of Black Swamp that actually drains it underneath the road. And then there are some channels here that they tried to drain it when they had agriculture around Black Swamp. And this goes into the Obine River, South Fork, okay? All right, what TWRA did is they came in and they created what's called a ring levee that does this, and it ties in ultimately to the slopes of this road, which is a really large road that functions as a levee itself. Okay? There's a water control structure right here. So they came into this area. What they were proposing initially, y'all, was to come in here And I think they were just going to do a massive levee, I think, like all the way down, like, I don't know, something like this, some huge mile-long levee. And, well, they didn't, and that's what they actually, they were denied the permit for. So what they did is they came in and they just, in this area, this is an upland area, okay? This is wetland. In this area, and then right in these locations right here, then they dropped in some gates. So now they can put boards in here, and these are actually screw gates, and prevent water. They can ultimately back water up. And they don't have any way of pumping or anything like that, but this is an entire watershed. So when it rains, it'll back this area up. So these are the three things that were built in August and September of this past year. And so what you're looking at here is the ring levee. We're walking down it right here, roads behind us, and here's this levee, and here's the water control structure, and then it swings back up. There's the nice water control structure. It's a drop board structure. See, staff gauge, riprap. And this is, TWRA indicated that this is not a wetland area because this is an agricultural drainage channel, and technically that is not considered a wetland. TDEC says, you know what, you're altering our water quality, and under state water quality laws, you're going to be backing water up, it's going to change the water quality, and you remember how strict the water quality laws can be, so technically, you know what, you needed a permit. And I think they're just really pissed anyways that they weren't consulted. So this is the channel that goes actually back on up into Black Swamp. This is looking back down here. Here's the drop board structure. It's already holding water. And then, you know, they can let the water out through this drainage channel goes down through Hoppin Refuge. Okay, that's Jim Johnson right there. Oh, there's staff gauge. There's the drop board structures that they have. And so September 12th of this year. Though here are the two structures that they have over here on the two channels that come out of there that prevent water from going into the Obine. So functionally they have the capability of preventing water from leaving Black Swamp. They can't pump water in or anything like that. That is Black Swamp, y'all. And what are those trees there? Any idea? It's water tupelo, yeah. This is a water tupelo cypress swamp. And it's a beautiful area. There's a class from Advanced Wetlands class. And Jim Johnson and Don Orr, who's retired Fish and Wildlife Service in Black Swamp. And the reason that Sammy King and Lee Fredrickson said, you know what, you shouldn't be building a levee here because this is not where a Green Tree Reservoir should be put. This doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to flood this area. You don't have high mass production. And plus, look at how dense these trees are. Really what you need to do is go in and open some of these areas. And this isn't the right area to put a Green Tree Reservoir. That's why they disagreed with it. And ultimately, the TDEC rejected it because there has been, at least in Tennessee, an effort to get away from putting levees in the floodplain. If you're going to do a Green Tree Reservoir, be out of the primary floodplain. And I'll tell you this, you know, levees in the primary floodplain can be fine if if you're flooding an area where the tree composition makes sense to be flooding. So you're not flooding a Tupelo swamp. You're flooding a area that has mass producing species, oak species. Okay. So this isn't a very good area to manage and to create a green tree reservoir system. I agree with that 100%. There are certainly better areas. Now it's kind of interesting because now TDEC has issued a consent order to TWRA and basically said stop everything. Stop everything now. You're in violation of our water quality laws, and now we're going to talk about this seriously. And so at this point, everything has been halted, period. And again, there are folks, I should say this, there are a lot of folks, the TWRA cannot comment on this project currently outside of basically one person. And there are a lot of folks that though with TWRA that disagree with this project 100% off the record. And there are the feeling is that probably again Clark Acres wants to see this developed. He doesn't need a spot for him to hunt. He has his own hunting area, but by God, I won this case, and I want to see this developed. I want this to go through with what was mandated by the federal. And you know, after all, he did take on the Corps of Engineers, who was pretty much it never lost anything. They've always done what they wanted to do, especially in 1970, and took him on as a civilian and won. So, the intent of that, you know, Clark Acres is considered literally really kind of a hero for West Tennessee in many capacities because he stopped the channelization of the South Fork of the Obine. And, you know, recently just with this Black Swamp area, and he's been, you know, really kind of pushing the governor and TWRA to have this developed. You know, it's his good efforts that happened because of the federal decision have been overlooked. So he has done a lot of good things for the state. But I agree with Sammy King and Lee Fredrickson that this isn't the best site to have as a green tree reservoir.
How big is that area?
It's pretty big. Actually, I think it says on that. I think it's something like 600 acres. 845 acres in Obine. What county is it in? Obine? Yeah, Obine County. And so let's read through this little handout here. This is where we are. We're up to speed. It actually doesn't have the most recent consent order that came out after this, basically telling TWRA, you know what, you can't do anything. So is this area flooded before they put in the water control structures? Yeah, I mean, it's a low-lying area. So it's obviously if you have water Tupelo in there, it'll hold water for most of the year.
So why did they even put in the water control structures?
I don't know. Why did they put in the water control structures? To flood it deeper, farther. You know, there really what needs to be done is, you know, what needs to be done is this area needs, you know, they would need to go in there and open this area up. They would have to have areas where they opened it up. They could even manage those openings as moist soil areas, and that could create some duck hunting opportunities. Even if you open these areas up and you really didn't do anything with it, or if you just flooded it deeper, whatever, it's not going to provide very many duck hunting opportunities because the birds First of all, there's not a whole lot of food production in these areas. They may be coming in and, again, getting seclusion, roosting areas, maybe getting some aquatic inverts. But the hunting opportunities, you know, you need to have some open areas to put decoys, to ultimately for the birds even to come in. I mean, ducks can't land in this. I mean, there's no way. I mean, maybe a wood duck might be able to zip in between here, but not a large dabbling duck. And I haven't walked all the way through Black Swamp. I'm sure there are some natural openings out there. But if it was going to be managed in that capacity and everybody was on board with, yeah, okay, let's make this a waterfowl hunting area, then just putting more water on it is not going to do it. Really, some other things need to occur. Okay, so that's kind of a little slideshow from our field trip last fall. Now, here's some evidence here of basically the change in tree composition that can occur by continuous flooding over time. And this work was actually done at Mississippi State University that compared a green tree reservoir flooded under the typical regime that I was talking about, the traditional regime, flooded every year deep, continuous, stable water levels, compared to a natural hardwood bottomland. And you can see a change in tree composition. In fact, this abstract is one of the, is copied here for you by Gary Young. But you notice in hardwood bottomlands, you have a higher composition of cherry bark and willow oak. And in green tree reservoirs, you have a higher composition of overcup oak. Overcup oak is a more water-tolerant oak species. And as you flood things longer, or even just naturally at lower elevations than a bottomland, you'll have more overcup oak. More overcup oak. Okay? I'll explain later why that might be an issue. Okay, so more cherry bark oaks in hardwood, natural hardwood bottomlands, more overcup oaks and other water-tolerant species in green tree reservoirs. Again, traditional management. All right. Now, why is this an issue? Let's first start with timber. These, even though this says 98, this is actually, I've checked these numbers, they're about the same. Cherry bark and willow oak trees, saw timber of those, you get about $350 per 1,000 board feet. For overcup oak, usually it's just used for pulpwood, and you get about $200 per 1,000 board feet. So again, you get about one and a half times less money, or 80% less money from overcup oak. Or this is 80% higher, however way you want to look at it. Okay? So cherry bark, willow oak, and water oak is another species. Pin oak, nuttall oak are all higher. They're all up in this higher timber value area. And those are all red oaks. This is a white oak. Okay? Overcup oak is a white oak. All right, now a study that one of Kaminsky's students did, Scott Barris, looked at acorn selection. And they used, they compared cherry bark oak versus nuttall oak and looked at selection rates. And these were wood ducks. Yeah, female wood ducks. And female wood ducks selected cherry bark and willow oaks at 75 or 77 times of a greater rate than nuttall oak. And why am I talking about nuttall oak now instead of overcup oak? Well, that's what they did their study on. But, well, I have a picture of this. And I don't know why they didn't use overcup oak. I think he wished he would have now. But at any rate, nuttall oak is a pretty good timber-producing species, and it produces a really large acorn. This is what the point is if you look at the acorn sizes, for cherry bark and willow oak, they're much smaller than nuttall oak. This is acorn size, length, and width. So they're basically 43, nuttall oak are 43 times larger, 43% larger. With respect to the thickness of the acorn, they're also a little bit thicker. The shell thickness is a little bit thicker for nuttall oak. So the whole idea, at least their hypothesis, is the reason that they may select nuttall oak acorns less is, first of all, they're larger, so they're harder for the bird to ingest. Okay, they're harder for the bird to ingest as well as digest because shell thickness. So in order to get to the meat of the acorn, where all the carbohydrates are, it's harder for them to ultimately digest. Those are the two hypotheses. Harder to ingest and harder to digest. So here's a picture of the four acorns that they used. You have cherry bark oak here, willow oak, water oak, and nuttall oak. You can see that, you know, these are comparatively quite a bit larger than these guys. And overcup oak is literally, that's about the size of overcup oak. It's even a little bit larger than nuttall oak. It has this massive cap. And we'll see, we'll be able to pick up cherry bark oak acorns and overcup oak acorns down in the Noxubee bottom, and you can see firsthand. I mean, some of them are just huge. I mean, massive. And I just want to look real quick. It seemed to me like this was on our, you can see the difference here. Right is overcup oak, and these are cherry bark oak. Okay? I mean, they're huge. They're just huge. You can see this big cap. Sometimes it completely encapsulates the acorn, sometimes it just comes down about halfway. Massive. So you can imagine, you know, this is not very good duck food. Although it's good, you know, I mean, certainly deer will eat it, squirrels will eat it, you know. So other wildlife will eat overcup oak acorns. It's just for ducks, it's not that good. And the timber's not as valuable. So two reasons why to manage for willow oak and cherry bark oak, or even water oak. Okay, so we did a little bit of work down at Noxubee looking at the effects of flooding on seedlings. And we're going to go that road that I showed you where we had the dynamic hydrology is this road here, which turns into a levee. We're going to be staying over here on Bluff Lake, right on this side. And you can, this is Locofoma Lake, which is another lake, and there's road goes down through here. But at any rate, you can flood this Green Tree Reservoir here at Noxubee by letting water from Bluff Lake flow down in through a channel system down in here, and then they capture the water with this levee. And then they can flow water from GTR1 over to GTR2 through this water control structure. And so we'll walk down in those bottoms and talk about some things. But anyways, when I was there, they were interested in looking at how flooding affected seedling survival. So they flooded one of the Green Tree reservoirs continuously for a couple years while I was doing this study. And then they had the other one just periodically flooded from overbank flow of the Noxubee River. So just kind of natural hydrology. And I looked at seedling density and height and seedling survival, that type of stuff. So we measured all these things, density and all this stuff back, I guess a while back now. And seedling survival, followed them for a couple years. lots of seedlings tagged and looked to see how they survived. And we did this, where's the species? We did this, there we go, here's the results, for willow oak, cherry bark oak, and over cup oak. And here's, this is the most important slide here to remember. And we published this eventually. You have a, I guess one of the last handouts you have here is our abstract from it. And it was published, I just mentioned this, because this is another good text. I'm going to pass this around. And this is going to be like that Green Tree Reservoir text that's going to be no longer available. You can currently get this through Gaylord Memorial Lab. It's maybe like $30 or something. And I'll pass it around. And again, Gaylord Memorial Lab is the lab and that you would contact for this publication. It's got a lot of great papers in there. I mean, just really, really good papers. Strongly recommend it if you're interested in bottomlands or in wetlands. Okay, so the bottom line here is you can see that in the continuously flooded GTR, there was always lower survival. That's the blue bar here, continuously flooded, compared to the yellow bar, which is periodically flooded. Letters above these bars mean they're really statistically different. And you can see in the first year, there was no statistical difference between survival of overcup oak seedlings and continuously flooded. And this means, okay, you put water in. The continuously flooded was they started flooding and holding water in November, and they started letting water out in February. So it's pretty much dormant season flooding is what we're talking about, not growing season flooding. And even dormant season flooding was having negative impacts on seedling survival. And but even the second year, after 2 years of flooding following these overcup oak, were negatively impacted by that continuous flooding. The first year, they seemed to be holding their own, but even overcup oak was having a hard time hanging on. A test, so the computer does. SAS is the the program we used. This was kind of an interesting thing. Lo and behold, all the seedlings that did survive were taller in this continuously flooded area. Not a whole lot taller. We're talking about centimeters here, but a couple centimeters taller. And overall, overcup oak were taller than the rest of these, as you can see. Only explanation for this is probably a consequence of the only way you're surviving in these continuously flooded areas is if you can grow taller and get above the flooded, the flood zone. Again, we're really just talking about a couple inches. Biological differences, I really don't know. I'm not quite sure why that happened or why that was occurring. Density was lower for cherry bark oak and overcup oak, and willow oak, it was a lot higher, but this is a consequence of just there were two plots that happened to hit randomly underneath of a tree and in a continuously flooded area, and it bounced our density way up, and that resulted in this average density being really high. It should be, without those plots, it'd be much lower than what you see here. But at any rate, survival was the bottom line in all this stuff is that continuously flooding these areas resulted in lower survival of the seedlings, willow oak and cherry bark oak and even overcup oak over time, over 2 years. The conclusions on density and height, well, we really don't know. They may not have benefited from the strategy. But so the recommendation, my recommendation to you all, is that we need to think about periodically flooding these areas, getting back more to a natural type regime, not flooding them for long durations. So that is how you can effectively manage a green tree reservoir. You can positively influence survival of seedlings, and you're not going to have those negative impacts on the adult trees, okay? Is by minimizing, emulating the natural hydrology, reducing the amount of dormancies and flooding. Now, from the picture that the hydrograph showed earlier of hydrology within a bottomland, it isn't reasonable to try to emulate that. You're talking about putting water in, taking water off, putting water in. I mean, that's just not economically or logistically feasible. But we can minimize the duration of flooding. And so at Noxubee, at least at that time, there were three green tree reservoirs. Now there's just two, but at that time there were three. And so what we recommended was, okay, we want to provide predictable flooded hardwood bottomland habitat for waterfowl during 3 months, December, January, and February. So let's sequentially flood these 1 month each, okay? So sequentially drain and flood one green tree reservoir each month. So you could start to let water in. My recommendation ultimately is at a maximum, you should be flooding these areas is really a month and a half, no more than 2 months. So you can start to let water in even in mid-November in a green tree reservoir. Slowly flood it up over 2 weeks. So by the end of November, beginning of December, you're at full pool. Hold it for 1 month and then begin letting water out over 2 weeks.
So, December, you're at full?
Yeah. Yeah. So mid-November, flood up. So by the end of November, duck season, you're at full pool. You're at full pool for 1 month. Start letting water out over 2 weeks. So by mid-January, that doesn't take you all the way through the hunting season, and my response to hunters are, too bad. You've got a month and a half of hunting opportunities. Enjoy it while it exists. But I'm not going to kill my trees. Okay? Now, if you did have more than one green tree reservoir, then you could have continuous habitat. So then at the beginning of December, you could start flooding up that green tree reservoir. By mid-December, you're at full pool, you hold it for a month, and then you let the water out by late January, okay? You certainly don't want to go past February with respect to holding standing water. I would definitely say you should have your bottom land dry by mid-February, because it's going to probably flood anyways if its hydrology is influenced in some capacity by the adjacent riverine system. Okay? So the whole goal is to provide, with green tree reservoirs and effective green tree reservoir management, is to provide habitat predictably for waterfowl, but minimize the stress on the trees, okay? Don't have water in there any longer than 2 months during the dormant season, and never during the growing season. I mean, there's tons of research that says to not flood during the growing season. Trees are gonna die. But you have to be cognizant also of lingering effects. That's why, you know, you can flood even during the dormant season. Our study was during the dormant season, still negatively affected seedlings. So you want to minimize that, okay, so that you're only flooding for the most total 2 months. And that includes the 2 weeks flooding up and the 2 weeks drawing down, only 1 month stable, okay? All right. Now, lo and behold, some other work that Kaminsky and his students did also indicated that aquatic invertebrate biomass was the greatest during the first month of flooding. The aquatic invertebrates just explode during that first month of flooding. Waterfowl use is greatest during that first month of flooding as well. And acorn availability is greatest. And this is probably because that's when they're most available. And then over time, acorns are depleted as they're foraged upon. So another reason, there's no reason to flood a bottomland for 3 months straight. Okay? Negatively affect your trees and also the birds are going to use it really right when it's freshly flooded. Yeah. Yeah, so why not mimic growing season flooding? These areas will flood naturally, not as naturally as it used to. But the problem is you probably just don't need to do that. These areas hold enough moisture just naturally with rainfall and stuff that you probably don't need to flood them. Willow oak, cherry bark oak, those oak species are facultative wetland species. They're not obligate. You start putting water on them in the growing, it negatively affects them, period. They don't do good with growing season flooding. So it almost isn't practical because you would just have to do it for a couple days and then take it off. And you might as well just let rainfall do that. But
did you say what kind of depth you're looking at here? We're still on
meeting. Okay, yeah, that's a good question. What about depth? Ideally, you don't want to flood any deeper than you would do your moist soil impoundment. So, 4 foot maximum all the way across all your contours. Some of these green tree reservoirs are huge, massive levees, and it'll be 10 foot deep, And if that's the case, what you should do is try to get funding to go in and have some cross levees that come across so you're only flooding at a maximum 4 foot deep. Yeah, you might have some additional, Now, green tree reservoirs, they tend to be quite a bit larger than moist soil units, which I mentioned were, 100 acres? Yeah. So they're often larger than bottomlands. The gradient is, the contour gradient would take a long time. So, I think that that's fine. I think they can be larger, but the depth is an important consideration. All right, I think the last thing I have here is talking about managing forest openings. And again, you have a group of abstracts here that really kind of summarize the wood duck selections, acorn selection stuff, use of aquatic invertebrate responses right after flooding. That's one. And then this one is actually right here. This one by that Kaminsky wrote, Wood Duck and Mallard, Winter Microhabitat Use in Mississippi Hardwood Bottomlands. And what it comes down to is what they documented is you'll find wood ducks all through a bottomland. All right, and if you've ever seen one, man, they can fly amazingly well through the trees. But mallards, like this one right here, needs openings. And so you need to have these openings for the larger dabbling ducks to get in, whether it's natural or whether you're actually making these openings. And I would suggest that you might as well manage some of these areas. Work with your forester with respect to creating open areas for birds to come in like this. But these also can be, again, you can manage these as moist soil areas, or they can be regeneration areas for hardwood bottom, for oak species. You can go in there and plant oaks. So they should be at least an acre in size, y'all. They should be at least an acre in size, and that allows the birds enough, at least the most dabbling ducks have that capability of coming down and landing and being able to take. So clearing the trees. These areas can be managed as moist soil areas, as I've already mentioned. So you can just, again, go in there every 3 years and disc them up. You could put some food plot areas if you wanted to. You can also use them as oak regeneration sites. So you can go in there and, you've created small clear cuts is what you're doing. And you've gone into these areas and you're just planting oak seedlings so that ultimately those will respond and you'll have an oak stand there. And then you just sequentially work with your forester creating openings over time. And these are great areas also for hunting, great hunting holes where you can set up your decoys and stuff. And this was actually, there's a shotgun shell right there, duck taking off. This is at Noxubee, and this was actually a youth hunt that they had, and Kaminsky used to get his grad students to come out and guide for the youths, and we would take them out there, their parents, and call ducks for them and stuff, and let them unload their guns at these birds. So possible locations for openings are natural openings, obviously. You can just make those, maintain those, or make them a little bit larger. You can go through your forest and find some undesirable species. You know, if you have an area where it's you don't have very many oaks and you want to create more an oak composition, you can go in there and make an opening there and use it as an oak regeneration site or just manage it for moist soil. Locations also, if you're using them for hunting zones, obviously you can really kind of systematically place these so that there's plenty of space in between so each, hunters aren't influencing each other's areas. And so you can think about placing them based in that capacity. And then I already mentioned the oak restoration. So all of these things, you think about creating these openings and you work with your forester or you have these prescriptions that you make yourself. You're just doing small clear cuts. It's pretty simple. You don't need a forestry degree necessarily to do that. Need to just call somebody to come in and cut your trees for you. And you generate money. A lot of times when you do this on a WMA or a refuge, those dollars go directly back into operating expenses, and you can use that for doing whatever you want to do. So with that, I'll end on a picture from Puerto Rico. I spent a few years down there, and this is what our bald cypress swamps used to look like. This is an old growth forest. This is not bald cypress. This is swamp bloodwood, which is their equivalent down there to bald cypress. You can see how wide across that is. This tree is 120, 130 feet tall. This is about an 8 foot. You can't even do DBH, it's massive across. It's about 8-10 feet across there. And it's wet. You can see we're soaked. You have to completely, permanently flooded. It's great. It leaches on you and scorpions dropping on you and stuff, fun stuff. Quicksand in those areas. So, okay, that's all I had. You guys have any questions? So that was waterfowl wetland management in approximately 8 hours. Now, if we were doing this during a regular semester, we would have spent literally about 3 weeks talking about it, and you got it all in one day.